there's a certain special interest in Milton in view of the present conditions of not only our own country but the world. John Milton, who was born in 1608, was not only a classical poet, but a perfect nuisance as a politician. This was an interesting combination of values. He has been remembered as one of the greatest pamphleteers who ever annoyed government. And he succeeded so well that the country really never got over his annoyances entirely. He was a person who, I guess we would say, was star-driven. From his earliest life, it seemed as though he had been selected for a special destiny. Highly gifted, of uncertain disposition, but of tremendous intensity of dedication, he has been remembered as one of the most important literary figures in the history of Europe. This circumstance began in childhood. Milton was a poet at 15, with considerable ability and a great penetration of spirit. He attended Cambridge, and from the day he got there till the day he left, he was troublesome. In fact, he was requested to resign at one time. He left, but he came back and remained altogether nearly 7 years in higher education, which he detested. But he was sacrificing his personal feelings for a certain amount of important information. He was quite certain that the universities were educationally delinquent. They did not teach what human beings needed to know. You could graduate from the best of them in those days with very little positive accomplishment except an increasing capacity to handle local beer. This was the main record of the universities for many years, the amount of liquor that they used. The educational side seemed to have been completely overlooked. Not only were these schools famous and infamous, but they were unhealthy. The atmosphere was moldy and wet and damp. The stone walls dripped. Most of the apartments and classrooms were dark and ill-ventilated. But those were the punishments that went with higher learning in those days. It is from the university, however, at Cambridge, that Milton gained his familiarity with languages. He did not learn very much about any important scholastic subject, but he learned to use the classical languages and several of the European languages with proficiency. He also has the principal distinction, however, of being one of the few of his time in his level of thinking who chose to write in English. Now, this in itself is an interesting phenomenon, because 15 or 20 years before the beginning of the 17th century, English was practically an impossible dialect. It was useless. It was very little better than the pure Chaucerian, which nobody could understand. Almost all of English at that time was local. There was idiom that dominated provinces. And when a group of soldiers had to train, being recruited from the various provinces, the orders of the day had to be given in several different languages, dialects, and idioms, because otherwise nobody understood them. Yet 25 years after that, we have one of the greatest examples of English literature ever done, and that is the King James Bible, a masterpiece resulting from a tremendous upheaval in thinking and in style and in education that occurred in these few years. So Milton started out to gain a classical education and at the same time to discover the inadequacy of the basic educational policies of his time. Realizing, however, that it was important for him to have certain contacts, he finally went back to Cambridge and stayed there for 7 years. And during this time, he wrote considerably in poetry, some prose. But he was mostly learning to use the tools of his craft. He had a magnificent vocabulary. He had a marvelous daring in his usage of words. And he was most of all tremendously dedicated on a religious level. Milton belonged to what might be termed in these days a dissenting clergy. He was definitely part of the, we might say, puritanical motion in England. He was Protestant in every sense of the word, and spent much of his time doing what the Protestants got their name from, protesting. He was very much of the opinion that the government of England was in very poor condition. And he had hardly graduated from Cambridge before the problems of the civil situation in the country became important to him. He realized that with King James the First departed, James was a kind of not a very dangerous man. He was just kind of a simple character who was able to accomplish a fairly long rulership without causing any very great excitement. And along the way, he supported and improved the condition of many scholars, including Bacon. But with his passing came Charles the First, who was unhappy, unfortunate, and disliked from the beginning. Charles seemed to feel that the people existed to improve the financial condition of the rich. We have heard of such things more recently. He was convinced that taxation was simply moving that which was necessary to the people to provide the luxuries of the idle. The aristocracy in his day was an aristocracy of birth, but it took advantage of its aristocracy to pillage the public. Charles was a spendthrift. He was completely indifferent to the needs of the people. He never listened to anybody. He did exactly as he pleased and favored his own clique to the very ultimate. As this condition continued and became increasingly worse, there was undoubtedly time for a revolutionary change. And in this particular situation, Milton found his mark. He became the spokesman of the underprivileged. He became, what might be said, rather hated by the upper group, but the group up there had practically no influence in controlling the actions of the public. The public was with Milton, and as a result of that, he was comparatively safe. In the height of this situation, there loomed upon the horizon Oliver Cromwell, who became Lord Protector of England, and the first thing he did when he gained authority was to execute the king. That was the end of Charles the First. Now, Cromwell was a man of iron character, and also a man of tremendous personal ambitions. Cromwell was as hard as nails. He was an old soldier in manner and quality. He was a strict, square-toed Puritan in almost every way. But, of course, he had his own ideas about how a country should be run. And in spite of every effort to bring the country into a better condition, Cromwell was concerned primarily with maintaining his own position, which was not easy, because England up to that time had been for nearly 1,500 years a monarchy. In the course of time, Cromwell's influence began to wane. He became more and more dictatorial. He determined to have his own way at all costs. He created his own cronies. He developed his own proselyting propensities, and gradually the public mind turned against him. He was, however, successful in holding his position to the time of his death. He was succeeded by his son, who lasted just 1 year. He did not have his father's strength, ambitions, and dramatic ability. The public, in the meantime, very much disappointed and unhappy over everything. They had gotten rid of one nuisance and gotten another in its place, decided that the great experiment of democracy in England was a failure. So they called Charles II to the throne, and he arrived in the midst of this tremendous conflict between the royalists and the republicans, or what might be termed the conservatives and the progressives. Charles started out with almost everything against him. But he was a more prudent man. It occurred to him that one of the secrets of success, as he regarded the career of Charles I thoughtfully, was to win the approval of the people. He might have his peculiar foibles, but he had to also represent them to some degree. He had to do something for them, and was fortunate enough to realize this fact. He was a scholar, much more so than his predecessors, and among his first public acts was to establish the Royal Society of London, which became the basis of scientific advancement in England for nearly 200 years, and included such men as Newton and other progressives in its list of members. The Royal Society was a success. It was built on the basis of Bacon's contributions to learning and dedicated to him. But Charles II, gained control of the situation. He was in very difficult times at first, but after a while, the English people settled back and accepted him, and he became comparatively popular. Now, what all this has to do with Milton is maybe not obvious at first, but remember that Milton was campaigning for Cromwell. Now, when Cromwell's party lost, the Lord Protector ceased to be important, and the Royalists returned in Charles II, Milton found himself in extremely difficult situations. He was picked out as being one of the rabble-rousers of the Commonwealth. He was prosecuted and persecuted. In fact, he was temporarily imprisoned. He was on the wrong side of the political situation, and this caused him a great deal of trouble. His pamphlets were publicly burned, and as far as his political career was concerned, Milton was finished. But this had very little effect upon his literary advancements. Actually, he was a poet of outstanding abilities, and in spite of the difficulties politically, he was finally given a chair at Oxford and was at that time also able to attain a considerable scholastic reputation. He had also, in the meantime, managed to get his master's at Cambridge. So as education went, he was in a comparatively secure position, but his popularity rose and fell every day. And in the midst of this, the great problem of his life set in. His eyesight failed. As a result of that, he remembered back to the time when he first began to see these light flashes in his eyes. Little by little, his sight became poorer. He had given practically his entire eyesight to research and study. He was an avid reader, a good scholar, and a good thinker. But his eyes had been not strong from early life. And by the time that he was through with his political career, John Milton was blind. He was completely blind. This, however, seems to have had very little effect upon his career. Having been finally liberated from political involvements, he settled down to the great work of his life, and that was the writing of his heroic poem on the biblical subject, Paradise Lost and Paradise Regained. Paradise Lost was practically a summary of the opening chapters of Genesis. It was based entirely upon the Protestant interpretation of the early parts of the Old Testament. There were certain additions, however, that arose from Milton's basic scholarship. He was well aware of the ancient legends of the Jewish people. He was conversant with Greek and Roman antiquities, theology, and theogony. He was more or less aware of the contemporary thinking of scholars of his own time, and when he visited Rome, he met and discussed his problems with another blind man, Galileo. So he moved in a good intellectual circle, but now, in his older years, he turned his attention directly to the cultivation of a great religious epic that he hoped would have lasting effect upon human society. Actually, at this time also, he had a family in which, again, tragedies were numerous. His first wife died, leaving him with three children. His second wife, whom he adored, died in childbirth. And all through his life, his conditions were uncertain. He was, however, fairly well cared for by a third wife and the children, who had been by this time grown up. But the children were not happy over the conditions in the family, because Newton had transformed his daughters into amanuenses. They had to take all of his verses and write them. He dictated to them morning, noon, and night for years, which was a little difficult upon young girls growing up. So it's understandable that they did not entirely appreciate the extreme severity of their father. Any question, any doubt, any uncertainty met a tremendous anger from John. He did not believe that anything could take the place or equal in importance or should be permitted to interfere with a labor dedicated to the glory of God. So his children became absolutely important to him, necessary to him. But he continued to feel that behind everything that he did was a pressure that was more than earthly. He used the medium of poetry in the presentation of his work, which was, of course, also the popular medium of nearly all of the early literary lights of the 17th century. He was in the same group of as the earlier Greek poets. There was something about his work that showed that he was well-versed in the Odyssey and Iliad of Homer. He was also well-equipped in the study of Hesiod. He was like many of the later men, like Dryden, who made a poetic translation of the Aeneas and Virgil, and, of course, Dante, whose Divine Comedy was given in verse. The great epics of that time were nearly always in poetic form. There was a tremendous vocabulary involved in this procedure, and it is amazing that any person unable to see would be able to continue to call upon the internal resources of his mind sufficiently to be able to dictate these very complicated expressions with the most involved use of unusual English terms. In any event, however, the work was a success from the standpoint of the original intent. As a reward for his labor of months and years in the preparation of Paradise Lost, Milton was rewarded financially by a publisher who gave him about £20 for the entire work. In other words, Milton didn't care. He wasn't interested in money. This is one very strong point in his favor. He made practically nothing out of any of his versifications. But that pleased him all right. He was not at all embittered by it. But the Paradise Lost became so popular that between the years 1700 and 1800, there were over 100 editions. At the same time, there were only a dozen editions of Shakespeare. Now, in those days, Milton's poem had a very wide circulation because it touched into the religious life of the people very intimately. It was almost like reading the Bible. and to many people, Milton became another prophet. The Old Testament has to do, of course, with that part of the life of our ancestors, from the creation of the world to the flood of Noah. And this was the area upon which the Milton prepared and wrote his Paradise Lost. The second part was suggested to him by a friend, Paradise Regained. In this case, it was the New Testament that became his instrument, and he built the entire theme around the saving power of Christ. The second part of the poem, however, has never had as great an interest because it is shorter and because it lacks the tremendous dramatic impact of a subject such as the fall of the angels and things of this nature. Now, it also appears that Milton had certain attitudes about life which were completely related to the early Protestant movements in England. The main one had to do with the problem of original sin. There was a saying that was all over Massachusetts during the 17th century, a sort of something that school children had to remember. Namely, with Adam's fall, we sinned us all. And the problem of original sin became a very important factor in Milton's thinking. Not because it satisfied him entirely, but because it was the only approach that was at that time acceptable to 17th century religious thinking. The idea of evolution as we know it today was unknown. There was no way of trying to solve the great problem, which is summed up in the concept of, perhaps put into the words of Buddha, as well as anyone has ever said it, namely, if God cannot prevent evil, he is not God. And if he can prevent it and does not prevent it, he is not good. Therefore, the problem was to solve this dilemma. And this became the basic background of Milton's theology, was to try to determine and understand the problem of original sin. Now, of course, this has plagued the church from the beginning. It has plagued practically all thinkers who have been idealists. The only people who are not worried about it are the materialists. They do not care. But there has to be, to the idealist, to the religionist, to the individual, the spiritual ideals and overtones, there has to be an explanation of the fall of man. Now, this constitutes a very large and spectacular and complex factor. And Milton, of course, approached it in the terms of his own day. But in so doing, he has also left to us a number of speculations which were inserted with certain variations upon the biblical theme. And in the study of these specializations, we get a glimpse of something else about Milton's philosophy that perhaps has considerable current value for us today. According to Milton, this perverseness in human nature, which resulted in the fall of man, was the direct result of the interference of Satan in the descent of the human family. Milton, however, seems to sense something else also. He seems to represent or figure that this perverseness in human nature is in some way inherent, not necessarily because of the sins of our remote progenitors, but because of certain continuing complications in our own natures. In other words, the individual, most individuals throughout time that we have record of, have fought a struggle within themselves in order to achieve some form of integrities. Each individual has had to overcome himself in one way or another. His self is composed of a compound of spiritual values and material pressures. The individual would do right, but evil is ever nigh unto him. Now, Milton accepts the general theory that this evil originates in the beginning of the race, But if he broadens his foundations, then Adam and Eve become symbolical of a collective humanity. That in some mysterious way, the individual was given what Aquinas calls a restricted or limited individualism. He has the power of personal choice. Now, this is important for one very significant reason. If man has no choice, then he can have no virtue. Because virtue must be a decision. And if there is no possibility of a decision, then there can be no even limited individualism. Many of the mystics have assumed that this is the problem that separates man from the angels. The angelic host, not having any power of restricted or limited individualism, obey inevitably the law of heaven. But man has to choose to obey. Now, this choice of obedience is in some way essential to his growth and development. Perhaps we can bring it down to the simple level of family life today. Children growing up are under the protection of parents, but all children at a certain time break away from parental influence. In the greater way of the Bible, this breaking away from parental guidance more or less represents the fall. The individual becomes responsible for himself. He must make his own decisions. He must choose his own integrities. He must dedicate his life to the unfoldment of his own resources. In this particular level of things, we find that the human being has what we call the power of choice. No creature has free will. Free will probably is not even available to deity. But free will is a thought that many people misunderstand. Free will would mean that you could do anything that you wanted to do. But limited more by circumstances, man has a power of choice. There are many things that he can't do, and he doesn't even expect to. There are many decisions that he can't make. He cannot do what he pleases. He can only do what he can do. Therefore, he has usually a series of choices. He can stay in the present job or get another one. He can marry the girl or not. He can decide on being a lawyer, or he can decide on being an architect. He can do all these things, but outside of a certain area, he cannot have free will. Now, the fact that he has not free will has a certain benefit. He is no longer dominated by an arbitrary code against which he can offer no resistance. He is now a free agent. He is now permitted to make his own decisions, and he is given the privilege of being right. This is the very important point in the whole thing. And this is brought out in Paradise Lost, when the time comes for Adam and Eve to be sent away from the Garden of Eden. The Garden of Eden would represent childhood. It would represent a parental control, and even in modern parenthood, many parents keep on saying, "Thou shalt not. You're not going to do this because I'm not going to let you." And the child remains comparatively docile for a while, but remembers these things. And the first time it gets a chance to do exactly as it pleases, it does so. Now, in the case of Adam and Eve in the allegory, they are sent out into a world in which they have the right to bear their own integrities. They must face life. In other words, in a strange way, when they are cast out of Eden, it means that they have reached the age of adulthood, that they have reached a voting age, that they reach the age when they can be conscripted into the army if necessary, and they have the right to be considered adult. Now, this means that suddenly they are individuals. Now, why is this important? Why would heaven want this? rather than to keep them forever as very pleasant children in under a complete domination of their elders. Well, in a sense, this is answered by the allegory or fable or parable of the prodigal son. The prodigal son is the one who goes out and gets into trouble. But when he understands and realizes his mistakes, he comes back, and for him the fatted calf is served on a very nice dinner. But the son or brother who stayed home is not so honored. The honor goes to the one who made a mistake, found it out, and corrected it. This begins the study of integrities. So apparently the reason why the individual is forced upon his own resources is because his compound nature, which he has gradually evolved from thousands and millions of years, has brought him into a complex situation within himself. He is composed now of a moral nature and an ambition. He is a pessimist and an optimist. He is healthy and he is sick. He is successful and he is unsuccessful. All of these things are due primarily to his own equipment, to the subjective forces of his own life. Gradually, apparently, it is important that man shall become greater than the angels. And this is only possible by virtue. In childhood, he is innocent. In adulthood, he must be virtuous. And the long years, lives, embodiments of growth through the many incarnations transforms primordial innocence into ultimate maturity. Now, this probably represents the wisdom of the guiding power that is far greater than we realize. We no longer need to think of deity as either unable to control evil or unwilling to. It is no longer this at all. It is the problem of a conscientious parent determined to lead its child to maturity, to make the child a complete person, to make the child capable of becoming the foundation of a future, so that humanity can establish a dynasty of growth and progress, which will go on until ultimate perfection is attained. In order that this could be possible, the human being has to stand on his own feet. And this is where most people today are still in trouble. Theology has not sufficiently required that religion must be a demand for maturity. Religion must be not merely a consolation of weakness, but an inspiration of strength. And until it is so recognized, the theologies are in trouble. Because religion is not joining something, it is becoming something. It may be that you join or you do not join. This is not the critical point. The critical point is that joining or not joining, the individual must develop, unfold, and mature his own resources. He must become a mature human being. The process by which he accomplishes this is one aspect of evolution. For evolution is not only the growth of forms through nature, it is the unfoldment of potentials from within the individual. Many mystics of ancient times were quite convinced that the spirit of negation in man is the demon, and that the fall of man is a fall of the human being away from his own integrities through inexperience or immaturity. Every individual makes mistakes. Every mistake is a fall. Most people who are thoughtful learn something from their mistakes, and this is an ascent. So that there is a constant conflict going on because no matter what we learn, we never seem to know enough. We never seem to be able to meet the future with full maturity of insight and understanding. In order to understand this, we also have to realize the temptation. For the temptation scene is one of the most delightful of all. Incidentally, of all of these theologians, Milton gives us something. Milton excuses the snake, which is a very big thing. He doesn't forgive the snake, but he excuses it, because he says that the snake was deceived in his own case, that the evil one came and deceived first the snake, and the snake perfectly innocently carried on the mistake. So this is one point where he has a certain variation from the traditional form. But actually, temptation problem has to do with the multitude of factors that are involved in the complex evolution of the human being. Here, Milton's Paradise Regained summarizes the matter very neatly, because through the Christian mystery, as represented in the life of the Savior and the writings of the New Testament, the individual is restored to his spiritual heritage. But the temptation now is something that is forever. The temptation today is abroad in the land in many ways. Young people are tempted to narcotics, alcoholism, and crime. Older people are tempted to avarice, to various deceits, ranging from minor misrepresentations to bank robbery. Crimes of violence arise on every hand. These are the result of the individual being unable to withstand the pressures of his own desires, his own appetites, his own false values, because he wishes to be a member of a peer group that is delinquent itself. He falls into delinquency. He tries to be competitive to the fashions of his time. He wants to be richer than the others. He wants to have more power than the others. He wants to be handsomer than the others. All of these pressures arise from false values inside himself. Now, the reason why he has these false values is because he hasn't been adequately trained by parents who had exactly the same false values, but perhaps were a little more conservative with them. Here an interesting angle comes into the story of Milton's Paradise Lost. When the deity observes that Satan is wandering around on the borders of the Edenic Garden, he feels that Adam and Eve should receive some special schooling in this matter. In other words, he did not wish to leave them hopelessly to the mercy of Satan. So the Lord, in his wisdom, sends down the archangel Raphael. And it is said in the Zohar and in the Talmud and in the Kabbalah that Adam and Eve attended the school of the angels. Particularly, they were taught by Raphael. They were taught by him the problem of the war in heaven, the problem of the deceits and so forth that had been brought into the world, the reason why sin and death had come, and all of these things. And they were warned by Raphael not to succumb to the temptation. And this was a word of wisdom. This was the advice of the guardian. Now, we can take Raphael and we can magnify him a million times, and we can say that Raphael becomes a personification of all the great idealistic religions and philosophies of the world. They are available to everyone. Great integrities have been honored in our human culture. Great teachers have our respect, Buddha and Christ, Muhammad, Zoroaster. All of these great teachers have the admiration of mankind. They have given the instructions to those whose immortal futures were endangered by selfishness, ignorance, and fear. But in most cases, these teachers have been honored, but their teachings have not been obeyed. For the most part, the individual believes that in some way his salvation merely comes from the acceptance that there is a better way of life, but is not impelled by an effort to cultivate that better way of life in personal conduct. So the teachings of Raphael in Eden run against the same problem as the temptations that meet us every day in our lives here. And when someone comes along in the form of the traditional snake or the source of the snake and whispers to us that we can get away with something, we are only too delighted to try it. We want to do as we please. We want knowledge. We want to eat of the tree of knowledge. But we do not want to be penalized for the abuse of that knowledge. We want to know the multiplication table, but we don't want to be allowed to use it to foreclose on the widows and the fatherless and to find common debt. But the individual gaining knowledge gains the greatest responsibility that is conceivable. And knowledge without integrity is one of the most horrible hazards the world faces. Skill without mind, without heart, without conviction can destroy civilization. So Milton is trying to tell us in a current form of verses that man was not able to support the instruction that was given to him by the archangel Raphael. Raphael, of course, does constitute the eyewitness, the mystic. And according to the medieval and early modern mystics such as Hildegard and Bamy, the archangel's testimonies are part of a great message from heaven. This same type of message is reported in the writings of Baron Emanuel Swedenborg. They were lessons from paradise, instructions, inspirations. But very few human beings have been able to really combat the negative influence in themselves. And the temptation is that if you have the knowledge, then your use or abuse of it determines your fate. Now today we are in this position where many of these points should be very obvious to us. We should realize that science has given us a tremendous amount of knowledge. It has also threatened our survival. We know that political sciences have given us great rules of government, from the Code of Hammurabi and the Code of Justinian and the Mosaic Code and the Code of Napoleon. They've all been great legal codes, which we have cheerfully broken.